Hello, everybody, and welcome to Lost Explorers. My name is J. David Osborne, and that is Chris Sacrosum. Chris, how are you doing this evening?
David, I'm pretty well. The best news of late was my group and I did a music gig at our local ghost town, which I think I've made mention of. It's quite an amazing layout. But the people who sort of own it and run it, it used to be an old gold mine. They do weddings and events there. So they have a really beautiful little frontier chapel. But the thing is, with my commitment to self-made instruments, not only did we play in the ghost town, we actually played the ghost town and really made some instruments from the materials, or actually, played on aspects of the town. So that was really cool. I'm feeling good about that. Feeling good about a few things. But how about you?
Doing good. I'm in Jacksonville, Florida, learning all about fences at an Airbnb. Hopefully the connection is good. My audio quality is not going to be as good as it normally is, but that's all right. We'll make it through.
We will.
We will indeed. But yeah, why don't we just jump right into it? Do you have a
Sure.
band and an aphorism for us today?
I do. Okay. Now the band is complex. They are called Neck Beard. Now they claim to in all members of the band slash troupe claim to be trans. We're not sure though, because they only appear with face paddles with the same blank face, but their dress is sort of radical biker lumberjack looking. But their sound is really like a 1980s Tears for Fears Spandau Ballet sort of sound. And the thing that is really controversial about them is they don't toe any party line. They raise a lot of questions, self-reflective questions about biological males in female sports. But their main focus is a concept album that is actually a murder mystery, too. It's called the Mystery Shower Power Hour. And it's meant to be listened to and the mystery solved, hopefully, within an hour of listening. So it's a weird throwback almost to radio plays, but with a new video game sort of sensibility, but based around a classic murder. In this case, there is a murder in the girls' shower of a large suburban Denver high school, and a trans student is implicated. And the question is, and the songs unfold the narrative of what really happened. Well, maybe that's not so easy to work out. So, the Mystery Shower Power Hour by Neckbeard.
Love that. Yeah, it's an escape room in the form of an album, kind of.
Nice. Yeah, that's I think that's a great metaphor model, for so many things. Yeah. I
Yeah,
need to get back
absolutely.
and do an escape room experience. There are a few good ones in Vegas. That's good. Thank you for reminding me. I really need to touch base with something concrete, not just the metaphor.
No, I can feel that. I sorry that I have a wash going in here. These are the perils of podcasting in an Airbnb, I guess, but we'll get through here. I think the internet will be fine. I'm not super worried about it. You can hear me okay? Yeah.
Okay, you ready for
That
the
washer's
aphorism?
distracted. Yeah, hit me with it.
Okay, it's kind of apropos of what we've just been talking about. A house is not composed of rooms. Story, prefigures, verses, and sentences.
It's great.
That really hit home to me. I think one of the things about getting in a thinking groove when you feel like you're actually thinking the kind of thoughts that you really want to have, some simple sounding things take on a dimensional resonance. You suddenly really think the idea inhabits you. Gets right in your chest, as Miles Davis would say. So, okay.
I was before I get to my imaginative challenge, I had a thought kind of along similar lines. So you've heard people say before something along the lines of, if you can hear your thoughts, who is the you who's hearing your thoughts,
Yeah,
right?
absolutely.
It occurred to me when I heard that, I don't know who that person is, but that is the person that writes, that's writing. I think whoever the listener is to the voice, it's not the voice in the head that's doing the writing. And I think maybe there's something to that about writer's block. But I like this idea of the story before the sentence, because that feels parallel, if not directly tied into this insight that I had this week, that story is coming from a not sublingual, but prelingual maybe place of the brain. And then it's getting filtered through that. And maybe writer's block has to do with attempting to write from the voice, right? Giving too much into the voice that you hear in your head. Instead of getting, because you know what I mean, like when you get in the groove of writing, and you'll hear people say, like, I don't even know where this is coming from. It's just, but it's the same place that whenever I'm doing this podcast, my speech comes from. Now, if I'm talking to somebody who I don't know as well as you, I might think about what I say a little bit more and it go through that translator. But when I'm doing this podcast, remember how I got freaked out like 6 months ago because we were talking about how the words were just coming out and I couldn't figure out, like, the voice wasn't, the voice is shut down right now. So I think that, again, whoever that is, that you, that's where art is coming from.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that you've touched on a couple of things that, the homunculus problem is what you were referring to at the beginning, that infinite regress of who's doing the watching, the hidden observer sort of issue, which is fabulous because it ties in with an early discussion we had about language beginning in paranoia. And sort of the joy and wonder of paranoia as maybe being the ultimate original human condition. And everything spins out from that. But another way of thinking about what you were talking, I think there's oftentimes a sense of art and creativity and even, well, sometimes genius has been thought of as returning to being a child at play. That sense of losing yourself. And that's the other part of that, of losing time like a child at play. But the thing that triggered in my mind, though, was the problem of the lone anthropologist. Because if you're in, say, a remote village situation, going back to my days in Melanesia, one of the problems with that is, and it's really excruciating, and it can be very physically fatiguing because of the mental strain, is wanting to lose yourself in the activities, say a festival or some sort of ceremonial event, and then having that sense of you, the anthropologist, watching. And then also, kind of in doing that, projecting yourself more into the scene in a negative way, which is exactly what you're trying to avoid, you know? So I think there's interesting things there that you brought up.
Absolutely. What is my imaginative challenge for today.
Okay, this is going to be fun. This is thought of in terms of a limited run streaming TV show, sort of HBO-ish quality, adult-oriented, so lots of latitude in how it gets treated. But it's called Project Puppet Chess. And it's set back in the Cold War side of the 1960s with CIA experiments going on and all sorts of strange behind the scenes government espionage stuff. Well, you are part of a very rogue, demented department in the CIA. And you decide to stage your completely off the books own little strategic warfare game. You target a nice suburb of Oklahoma City, okay? Somewhere where you're familiar with. And your goal, this remember, this is the 1960s. Your goal is to make a group of suburban housewives believe that they are, in fact, espionage agents involved in a tremendous neighborhood conflict for control. So there's a good side and a bad side, but they are secret agents, really. They can do their part. What they're, if you see something, say something. So it's really suburban paranoia, 1960s style, open for darkness or humor or both.
I love it. It's great. I can do that. All right. The subject for today, continuing on our travel and tourism talk. This is Chris. Oh, and you sent, I didn't even see this picture beforehand. That looks like a like an alien creature praying to some eldritch god.
Good, you
Cool.
got it. That was kind of on my mind. Well, this is what was,
Yeah, it looks cool. Travel becomes tourism. This sacred to profane style degeneration is hardly an isolated phenomenon. In fact, it might seem to be a deep algorithm. But I think the progenitors of the tourism age can, to some extent, be forgiven. It's fine to say now that they should have extrapolated, seen ahead to what large-scale, organized, budget-minded transportation of people around the world for the purposes of recreation or information, fulfillment of some kind, what that would mean, what impact. Think of Tahiti and Hawaii, Venice and Dubrovnik, Yellowstone National Park. The problem is the education has so much more to do with tourism than with travel, and has for several years. Public education tried to apply the values of trade school, standardization, consistency, certification to a liberal arts model. Man, that's true. While wholesale abandoning the trade school and apprenticeship streams. Meanwhile, liberal arts succumbed to customer service. Here's the concluding sentence of one of my students' analysis of the essay, The Loss of the Creature by Walker Percy. Which is as much about this theme slash crisis as anything can be. If you don't know the significance of William Faulkner, the story of Robinson Crusoe, the message within A Brave New World, or the man who discovered insulin, it may be very difficult to understand, and Percy's true message may never be revealed to a 21st century student. That's great. That's great. That's better than my students who would have just written the letters IDK.
Well, I have to say that this is comes at the end of quite a long struggle in that class. The
Yeah.
my other class, both of these are about the same size, but the other class is even larger. They're tremendous. They just absolutely really engage with this at a relative, they're at the level I would expect of a state university. Well, the standards are still, but this first group from which that excerpt comes, and she's a pretty good student. She's got good commitment. I don't know if she realizes how downbeat that ending is. That's her final sort of sentence. I mean, I read that and I thought, wow, that's about as disheartening as, anything can be. But then you reminded me so simply, as you have the ability to do, IDK is a lot worse.
It's a lot worse. I have a I had a on my last test that I gave them, I said that if I saw the letters IDK anywhere on their paper, it was an automatic zero. No questions asked.
There you go. There
You know?
you go.
But yeah, no, I mean, I really like this connection that you're making to where this kind of standardization and consistency, that's what you would want with welders.
Exactly.
You
Exactly.
know, you want them to be able to weld a straight line. It's very
Yep.
important. And
No
sometimes
kidding.
you want them to be able to do that underwater. Now, when it comes to a liberal arts education, they're such separate beasts, but it totally makes sense that if you take the free-floating anxiety and emotion and sort of femininity of the liberal arts mode, the female side of it, I should say, rather than femininity, and you put that rigid consistency on it, you get HR. You get middle management. You get a kind of behavior, attempt at a behavioral consistency rather than a craft consistency.
Beautifully said. That is exactly what's happening. And it explains so much about academia, particularly the higher end of the education system, because the administrative bloat is inevitable from what you've just said. That's absolutely what happens. But I think that ethos permeates the entire ladder of education. I think you can see it all the way down to, so, I mean, Lisa would certainly agree and she's teaching at the third grade level, but I think it goes all the way to kindergarten and in our preschool. It's an approach that is so radically off point when you look at earlier modes of education. I mean, there's a big comment made in education history circles that prior to the 20th century, we, as in, say, Western civilization, were educating 2% of the population. And then we tried to move up to 60%. Those are the kind of numbers, or at least the scale that's talked about. But what nobody mentions going back to, say, the two, which could have been 6%, is that that's tremendously high level academic, scholastic, liberal arts style education that we can't even conceive of offering now. Meanwhile, we're not looking at the people outside that system. Were they uneducated? I don't think the wagon makers were uneducated. They certainly were
Correct.
unskilled. I mean, we had stonemasons doing stuff that we can't replicate now.
I saw a guy today named Horace, who I believe was Haitian or from some sort of Caribbean island. But a lot of the fencing crews don't want to work with him because they say that he's, quote, trying to bring back slavery. Because he gets there at 7 and doesn't finish, doesn't take breaks until his job is done. And to
Oh,
see him
wow.
dig fence posts, he makes it look easy. It's him and one other guy. He's got to be making money hand over fist with these jobs that he does every day, only using one worker. But he kind of single-handedly, with a helper, puts, 300 feet of fence up, and he's digging these holes himself and plopping posts in and dropping the cement and slapping the boards together. And he's definitely got a sort of mindset that you would not call unintelligent, right? I mean, he's definitely skilled. I mean, you see that with a lot of these guys, they have There's something going on that is absolutely attuned to systems and consistency and repetition, and it's beautiful in its own way. But whenever you try to apply that to writing or thinking or philosophy, you end up with what we kind of have to, that's, you know what, man? Now you got me thinking about how much we see sort of behavioral kerfluffles in art these days. Like, it feels like, particularly the horror community in books, is like they're always fighting about somebody. There was one recently, there was a dust up about an editor for a new anthology that had, Chuck Palahniuk and Joe Lansdale and people in it. But, there was this like cancel, there was this very kind of almost pre-COVID cancellation of this guy when it happened. And it from the outside, because I'm getting all these accounts secondhand, it really does feel like, in a way, like humans trying to apply some measure of consistency to an anthology. Okay. Now, you can't have, because art can be subjective, you can't have that kind of consistency in and rigor for the actual work that gets in there, because Chuck Palahniuk is getting in there no matter what. It could be his least good story, he's getting in there. So there's no skill consistency level with that. Now, again, I'm not saying that his story's bad, but you know what I mean. But you can apply a moral consistency to it that you can then enforce with rigor and nab people based on behavioral issues that are not, quote unquote, up to code. So is it just the human desire to have everything come up to code? And when there's no agreed upon code, we have to make one? It's not all of it, but it might be a part of what's going on there.
Well, I think one really fundamental thing that's going on is that we're taking that notion of up to code so much for granted. It's absolutely terrifying. We don't have any idea of how long it took to really bring that to some degree of fruition. And then some kind of consensus, because like railroad gauges, think about those sort of very structural things that, well, they ended up paralyzing Australia as unification for a long time because they were different. So it made interstate travel really difficult. We have all these little structural ways that can really create, either havoc or harmony. And we really, really take them for granted. And I think that one of, you've just given me an insight as to why. I think there were some very, very strong minds, Euclid comes to mind, who really bridged the conceptual and the physical in a really careful way, as you'd expect a geometer to do. I think we started to get into, particularly within the Greek philosophy stream, we started to get away from the sciences. We started to get away from knowledge and epistemology, how we define knowledge. We started to get more into language games with the sophists and using argument and rhetoric as a way, in a sense, to trick people. But then we get to finally the Stoics. And a really an emphasis on personal behavior and ethos. And we moved entirely away from physical stuff. And I think that led to a schism between intellect and craft, artisans, skills. I mean, I remember early in my time, as a Black Mountain fellow, there was a graduate student who I thought was very switched on from El Paso, who had been out working on the big construction sites in Vegas and wanted to write a nonfiction, semi-anthropological book on what that's like, what that world is like. Those workers, where do they live? Are they local? Are they itinerant? What's the racial, ethnic mix? All sorts of questions. Well, the head of the writing program said, I don't think that's a very interesting topic. I mean, for starters, there's no such thing as an uninteresting topic in the right hands. I know you agree. But I think that's a hell of an interesting topic. I think that's a startling insight into maybe a city, maybe a much larger picture of America, a sub-economy, a subculture, an approach to skills and training. I mean, I just think you peel that one back, and I think we'd learn a lot about America. A lot about Las Vegas, anyway. But I think that the upshot is there is a kind of looking down the nose at skills. And then there's this resentment about the price paid, for plumbers and electricians, and air conditioning people, everybody, and I've been one of them, It's easy to be grumpy about that. And then you think, well, the first order of gratitude is that there are people who still have those skills. We're going to look at Gus's, growing up is going to see some challenges on that front. And then, if you need it, you need it. And that's the price.
Speaking, this is a bit of a digression, but I thought you would really like this. So while I was out and about today, the salesman who I was working with talked about some of the wealthy Floridians who he sold houses to, or fences to, rather. And I wrote down some of the things that made these people millions, if not sometimes billions of dollars. So he told me that he was talking to a guy who was maybe 65, looked 100 years old, chain smoking cigarettes, paying a fortune for this fence. He said, "Hey man, what do you do?" And he's like, he was a chemical engineer, right? And he said, "Oh cool. So what did you do with that? How did you make all this money?" He's like, "I'm the guy who figured out how to make coffee taste like cinnamon. And I'm not going to tell you who my client is, but it rhymes with Funkin' Donuts." So the guy who figured out how to make coffee taste like cinnamon. Another one he said was the guy who invented the plastic wrap that Kraft singles come in, the kind where you like tear the top part
Oh,
off.
wow. Yeah.
And another one who figured out how to make purple ketchup.
I've never seen that. Have
I don't
you?
think it was I have, yeah, I've seen the purple ketchup and green ketchup and all this different types of stuff. But yeah, crap, the
Where?
crap.
How have I missed that? Where
It was a
have you?
fad. It was a fad. You weren't a 90s kid, so you wouldn't have seen the purple ketchup, but it was definitely a thing. Now, but you've seen the cheese, you've seen the
Oh
plastic on the side.
yeah.
And
Unfortunately.
the guy who learned, like when you go to Starbucks and eat the cinnamon flavored coffee or whatever, somebody figured that out. And that guy made a huge mountain of money. And I just thought it was so funny because I have a friend who I went to school with whose family had had money. And that money happened because his great grandparents owned a ball bearing factory in Germany. And so it was just they just made ball bearings. And just this idea of like when you mentioned the money that plumbers and HVAC people make, you really do suddenly start to realize that when you come from an art background, you look at celebrities and these people who have become wealthy based on very rarely, but occasionally from their books or from their films or from their music or sometimes just for being a celebrity. But most of the wealthy people who live in country clubs, it's something like that. They created the little these like these little they invented this kind of head for a charger, you know, or something like that. So a little bit of a digression, but interesting
Well,
nonetheless.
it's interesting because I've returned of late to the Spanish philosopher Ortega y Gasset, who I think is a really amazing writer. I read him a lot back in the 90s, and then I haven't gone back to him for a while. But he's got a lot of really interesting things to say. If you haven't read him, you'd really just dig him. And I recommend him to all our listeners. Quite a number of works translated, all his major works. The Dehumanization of Art is an absolute must read. But to tie into your concept of these weird inventions, these seemingly trivial little things almost. He had a hypothesis that we misunderstand science, that we think too much in terms of Newton or Darwin or Einstein. And really, the heart and soul is very, very modest little innovations by relatively obscure scientists often. And I think that's true about the whole weird world of inventors. I've known some of those people, and they're very, very eccentric. And by that, I mean they have this strange mania in common, perhaps. They're inventors or wannabe inventors. And yet, outside of that, they are completely distinct. They have no, it's a very, very peculiar thing because they are this fraternity or community, and yet they're utterly one-offs.
I do think that that is a nice point to close the travel versus tourism on, though, because I think that relating it directly to education and this idea that we tried to take what we do with the trades and apply that to education, that same kind of, you know, you want every welding cut to be the exact same, but you don't necessarily want every journey to look the exact same like that. And so tourism has this ability to make it so that, you know, you hit all the same stops, you buy all the same trinkets. Often you're meeting the exact same people. And the idea of travel is one of just going off the book at least a little bit, sometimes more than a little bit. And applying that to education, I think would be, I think we've mentioned this before in a previous episode, but education really needs to reimagine what it's even doing. If we're going to keep these kids for 12 years, we've got to put those 12 years to good use. Because something that I've noticed as a teacher for my year as a teacher is that for a lot of kids, that 11th grade is a total waste of time. You know, they're in a kind of stasis. And not to sound too much like a horrible person, but they'd probably be better served already in the workforce or learning. A lot of them are, right, at McDonald's or whatever. They'd be better served out, like getting out into the world and learning how it works. Maybe spending a few years learning how to balance their bank account or, you know, make investments or whatever, right? Or learn a trade. They don't need to be learning about English at that point.
Well, and I've mentioned this before that I've generally had a pretty positive experience with students who come from a military background, whether that's totally behind them or they're still committed in some way. I feel particularly strongly about that this semester. I think that I'm seeing nothing but positive good, and I know for a fact that the students in question would simply not be in university at all. They needed that structure, they needed that training, they needed that confidence. There's so many, that's a good example of something that is available right now, to fill in some of this terrible gap. Meanwhile, we need to reinvest in trade schools and apprenticeship programs. What a great idea that was for so many, many people. Certainly boys, yes, but I don't think only boys. And I certainly don't think that would be true today if it were active, you know? And meanwhile, to try to resuscitate a liberal arts spirit within education before it's entirely too late. But I'm afraid that is a bigger boat to turn around than I know how to do, you know?
There might not be any way to do that, but I had a question that is completely out of left field because I just saw a mosquito. So in the spirit of travel over tourism, I'll ask you a question that you might know the answer to. There, you get a shot for malaria when you go to places where malaria is a real problem. You got malaria. So, and you still sometimes have, so it's this horrible virus that comes back to haunt you every once in a while. My question is, what, we have mosquitoes here, so how come, even though there's treatments for it, how come malaria never really came in a big way to the US?
Okay, a couple things. There is no real shot that's anti-malarial that you can
Okay.
really take, that you can count on. Chloroquine has been the recommended thing for years as a kind
Right.
of early preventive thing, but it really doesn't work. And it is for life. And there's usually between one or two major reboots. It's unusual for people to have like real more than that. Although, if you do have malaria, as I do, anytime you feel at all excessively hot for reasons that, you know, maybe other people don't seem to be, you instantly start thinking of that you're coming down with it again, you know. So there's a paranoia thing always to it. Okay, your question's a good question. Well, America did have a problem with yellow fever, for instance, and there are other, you know, tropical diseases that get in here. But it's an interesting longer term question about maybe some kind of immunity. I don't actually know the full biological or entomological reason why, because I know we're seeing examples of West Nile virus carried by mosquitoes. I think, you know, probably we shouldn't take that entirely for granted. I think that not enough of the United States is, you know, I mean, where the malarial regions are they're equatorial, you know. And not much off at either side. So there's not much of the United States, you know, none really, you know. So that's really a latitude answer, I think.
That sounds good. That sounds, I'm taking a sip of my Icelandic water.
Oh, nice. You know, is it good? Is it worth it?
Worth the cash. You want to hear my
Yes, take us to Project Puppet Chess, Episode One, the pilot.
episode one. So I love the idea of a stranger coming to town. That's one of my favorite narrative devices. And this would employ that device. It would play off of a film that came out in 2001 called Visitor Q, directed by Takashi Miike. About a strange visitor who intrudes upon an extremely abusive household and kind of the father, the mother, the son, and the daughter's lives for the better. Although it's really hard to say.
That's cool.
It's a pretty disturbing film. Some call it one of the most disturbing that they've seen with all the necrophilia involved. It's played for laughs, by the way. However, in this, the stranger who comes to town is a vacuum salesman. I like the idea of there being a door-to-door vacuum salesman who is the CIA plant. Part of his pitch would include the idea that people who are not buying the vacuum aren't supporting American patriots. Now, that would be what he said to half the town. The other half, he'd be laying in some subtle communist propaganda.
Baby.
So he would be, and then he would be seeding some kind of distrust because people who were getting given the communist spiel would be given a discounted rate if they all agreed to buy the vacuum from him at the same time, because, being in it together. The next step would be to leave the vacuum customers with a mail order catalog. And I really like the idea of using special effects here to make a mail order catalog come alive. A lot of the shots would be instead of, the audience having to read these screens, whoever the models were on the pages would come alive and would be speaking to the people in this way. But one would be American capitalist themed, and the other one would be Soviet communist themed, right? Like, you need to buy this particular lawnmower for the good of your community. And then the other one would be like, be the baddest mom on the block with your new egg beaters. Holy shit, that's the biggest goddamn roach I've ever seen in my life. Sorry, I got distracted.
You
Here,
want to take care of it?
I'm gonna let him do what he wants to do. This
Okay.
is just as much his room, I guess, as mine.
Next, the Burmese python's coming.
Florida's different, man. It's a different place.
Davidson, Florida.
No, fuck, man. I've seen some crazy stuff since I got here. Anyway, to wrap this up, the first huge major point of contention will be when people start getting their pools installed, and the idea will be seeded that, some people aren't letting other people use their pools as much as they maybe should. And why is Susie not bringing her share to the potluck? That would be the first episode.
Yes. Oh, I love the suburban texturing. That's what I was hoping for. Because, of course, I mean, it isn't really even an allegory. It's too true in a weird, weird way. And I think he really got some of the flavor there. I love the vacuum cleaner salesman going door to door. My stepfather, when his shop went bankrupt. It just didn't work out. And all he'd spent his retirement on that. And it was just a rough time for business. But he bounced back by selling Electrolux vacuum cleaners door to door. It was very intense, very intense. But you also got me thinking that, these pyramid scheme things are back in the news. What's the kind of marketing that it's called? Amway and Mary Kay and
The I think that's
there's a
called it's called pink Cadillac scams or something like that, because the Mary Kay, if you're the top seller in Mary Kay, you get the pink Cadillac. And I think that became a sort of shorthand for it. But it's like a MLM, multi-level marketing scheme.
Multi-level market. That's what I was thinking. Some sort of real business schools. Yeah, which is really a pyramid scheme or, something like that. That's so American, these things. And yet it's and it seems lost in time, but it's not, and it's back in the news. I just saw it just quickly the other day. Well, look, I thought that was great. I thought you really got to that flavor, and I just never tire of that era and that possibility, those conflicts. You can't beat it,
Yeah, it's good. Free cell phone. Keeping up with the Joneses style. I mean, Lynch really taps into it, but yeah, it's ripe for our entertainment purposes.
And we can't really get to the divisions between, the Dems and the Republicans. It's too hot, or too boring. People want to get away from that. So that allegorical distance back to Cold War suburbia and secret espionage, and it's Peyton Place, There's a reason why that sold hundreds of millions of copies or whatever. Okay. Are we great job. Are we ready for the tool?
Let's go.
Okay, this ties in with a key line from my book, The Near Distance on Memory and Alertness. The simple admonition, be your memory. And that gets phrased and rephrased in a lot of different ways and looked at from different points of view. But as opposed to the possessive verb of to have your memory or to use your memory, and then you get to that problem that you started the show off with. If you're using it, which you is you, it gets on and on and on. Too many hidden observers. Rather, I just think this is a good example of getting out a pen and paper and doing some drawings and thinking of two Venn diagrams. But in the back of your mind, have that optical illusion of the Greek vase or vase and the two faces. I think everybody knows what I'm talking about. You can see one at a time, but you can't see both. It's hard to hold. It's a foreground background issue. But with the Venn diagrams, try to do a kind of inventory, a comparative inventory of how does your sense of memory relate to your self profile? What's the difference? In what ways are these two Venn diagram inventory frames, in what ways are they congruent and how do they diverge? And of course, there is no final answer to that. It's endless. But if you actually start doing that in physical drawing terms, to trying to relate these two concepts two word forms, I think that you learn a lot about language and more importantly, how you, as in one, uses language. And you really do start to get a very strange oscillating of dimensional connection. And there are moments where the two really do merge. So memory and sense of self are, in my view, indistinguishable. It's only a kind of a lens issue. It's a seeing perspective, and because we have that frame, we expect to see it, and so we do. But this exercise, it's just good to be drawing some things. We like Venn diagrams, and I think thinking of those as our profiles and how they might intersect or not. That would be very weird if they really didn't intersect at all. That would be astonishing. That would be worth knowing. Some people might have that experience. That would be very, I'd love to talk to them. So that's my tool. The
Beautiful.
tip is simpler. It comes from a music piece that I was finishing off, and I added some little tiny moments that were very frustrating and difficult, and I really got kind of OCD perfectionist on, but little hints of odd percussion. I've got all these little, things to hit, bells. I got a whole table. And I knew exactly three of the sounds, extra sounds that I wanted, but there were a few more that I didn't. So that was very experimental and time consuming. But my tip is take the time for grace notes and finishing touches because they might end up seeming the most important part of whatever it is you're working on. I think this applies across anything I can think of. But inversely, because we like the inversion method, you can also invert the process and eliminate grace notes for an alternative effect. So you absolutely embrace them by utterly dismissing them. Bare minimalism. And I think there's an argument for that, but I think the idea is the same, it's just we see it inverted.
There's a band that I really like called Sleep Token,
Ooh.
and they're a metal band who has created a they've created a whole lore around themselves that they are a devotional group to a god they've invented called Sleep. And so all their songs are kind of devoted to this god or whatever. But there's a really good song that they have where they have this big metal breakdown, big heavy guitars, dun dun dun. But then there's a point where it cuts off for a split second, and you hear a single scrape, the wooden agogo, like the wooden scraper block. They just
Yeah.
go brrrt, and then it goes right back into it. And that little brrrt is never repeated in the song,
Right.
and it makes the whole song.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. And, they probably agonized over whether or not that was worth any time at all. And their hope was that someone like you would have that experience.
Oh,
And
I
that's the whole
screamed when
essence
I heard it.
of it.
Yeah, I screamed when I heard it. I was like, oh man, why has that never been done before? Why did nobody
Yeah.
do the little brrr in the middle of a metal
Oh,
breakdown?
that's exactly what I'm talking about. That really brings that to life totally.
Those were great tools and tips. Have you had dreams? Because all of my dreams have been about I had this interesting dream. I was learning about kind of utility marks on the ground that are laid out before you dig, like where like they're
Yeah.
called utility lathes, right? And in my dream, Gus and I were in the desert. And we were looking at utility lathes, and I was telling him where each one was. And then we came upon this shack that had a ladder that went deep down. And he and I investigated this underground labyrinth. And then I realized, oh, shoot, your mom is expecting us back. So we go back up the ladder, and there's this, 60s Impala waiting for us. We get in it, and we cruise off through the desert back home. But I thought that was a very interesting on the nose type dream that happens every once in a while. It's like,
They do. They do. And those are interesting to journal and note because there is an underlying algorithmic, pattern to when they do appear, I think. Certainly worth following through on that. I love the detail of a Chevy Impala. That was my father had one of those sea green with a white hard top. And I would kill to have one of those in good condition. Beautiful.
They're cool
Beautiful.
cars. I actually saw one of those here in Florida with glowing rims. So that was an interesting synchronicity. But yeah, it was like if we could, I was telling you, if we can decipher these utility lathes, we can find our way through the labyrinth under the surface, right? So we have to memorize these so that we can find, I don't even remember what we were looking for, as is the way with dreams. But how about you? How have your dreams been?
Okay, well, I've made a point a few times across the nearing to the 200th show that one of the odd elements of my dreams that I've got complete validation, going back over really 4 decades now, that celebrities, generally speaking, don't figure into my dreams anywhere near the way you would predict, given the exposure during waking consciousness and the societal emphasis on them. So I really pay hyper attention to moments when there is an intrusion. And this one strikes me as very odd because I really have no, well, I have as minimal engagement with her career as I think you possibly can, while obviously knowing a lot about it and having seen her many times because she's huge. Barbara Streisand. I was
I was
kind of
thinking it was either going to
surprised.
be Streisand or Taylor Swift. Those are the two
Yeah. Okay.
that
Well, you see, yeah, that's good. Taylor Swift, the nearer in time, and Barbara Streisand, sort of the classic, going back to
was
what's like my childhood. But the core image, and I've also said I think dreams have an oscillation between really strongly image-based, event-based situations, and far more complex narrative stories, which often get confused and lost, and only a little bit gets remembered. But what falls between those poles doesn't get remembered at all. Well, in this case, there is a laneway in Boulder City, where I live, which is behind a restaurant and at the back of the dive bar. And there, for whatever reason, has been a faded red plastic canoe up against the cinder block wall near the dumpster. Well, in this case, I was walking past it, and there were quite a number of people around. And to my amazement and mild disgust, the canoe was filled with macaroni and cheese, and someone
That's so gross.
serving out of it paper with paper plates, as if a kind of a refuge, soup kitchen kind of thing. And the sign behind them, crudely made, said, "Rock the Mac, not the boat." And I was just about getting really just a little bit nauseous because that much Velveeta yellow cheese, a big, three-person canoe full with soggy, not fully cooked noodles, it was really difficult to process. Then up out of the mess of noodles and cheese comes this nude woman who steps out of the canoe, kind of like, well, a mummy coming to life, and just staggers off toward Arizona Street. And that made me think of a moment that I'd forgotten when I was in New York City attending a workshop over a weekend by Harold Bloom. If we haven't ever, that's good. And it was really, really odd. It was on Fifth Avenue, but in a really old building that looked like where Twilight Zone episodes were filmed. And the cast of characters on the workshop was there was ha Harold Howard Bloom, of course, not Harold Bloom, sorry. Howard Bloom, not Harold Bloom. The guy, the disinformation guy, remember him? Yeah. And David Bowie's business manager, for whatever reason. There were other people too. And all like, yeah, some neurosurgeon. But at one point, this woman walked in, the most spectacular body on a woman over 30, I think, that I can recall. She was completely naked except this green, translucent, luminous, sort of nighty. But she was dressed as the Statue of Liberty. And she was completely out of her mind. And it was really interesting how Howard dealt with her, although it later occurred to me that someone should have helped her because she was obviously out of her mind, and walking around like that was kind of an invitation for trouble. But anyway, so I came out of that, and I woke up on this note and I followed through on it. So this is another kind of tip. In the dream, I was in the parking lot of Trader Joe's on Sunset, which I don't live anywhere near and haven't gone to for a long time. But I had this sudden, overwhelming sense of you can't unring a bell. I have no idea what that meant, but I had that so intensely. So today I drove past there. I don't know what it was, but I still felt these ripples,
Oh, cool.
Yeah, like kind of a David Lynch portal. No
Yeah.
explanation, no direct meaning, no clear message, not, but still this vibrational sense of some sort of seam,
That's awesome. That's awesome. I feel like that happens too when you. It's the same kind of thing that happens when you have a dream about somebody who you know and wake up with a strong feeling and then talk to them. You get that kind of sense as well. It's not an overlay exactly. Seem is the right word for it. Kind of the idea that, it's not even that the dream opens something up, though. It's more like the seam comes first, and then the dream notices it and draws your attention to it in the waking world. But I wonder what that's about, because I've experienced similar things as well to that.
Well, one thing that it has to be about in some way is that the location in question in the Trader Joe's parking lot could not have been more mundane, incidental, and unrelated to absolutely no significance whatsoever. Emblematic of apparent non-significance. So that's one thing. What does Borges say? We don't dream of a sphinx because we don't get anxious because we've dreamed of a sphinx. We're anxious, so we dream of a sphinx. Isn't that how it goes? I think that's how it goes.
That sounds right. Yeah.
I think that we have oftentimes just the reverse perspective on how some of these dynamics actually affect us. Because we think instantly on a level above the actual associative coding where the real interface is happening. I think it's like the analogy is with a word. We don't see the individual letters. We instantly come to a word form. And then we don't see words, even though they're very carefully separated, and that was a huge evolution in human learning and printing and everything. We go to the semantic level of what does it mean, and we never see those letters. We never look at a letter and go, wow. And why aren't there more of them? Why, why
Why is it
20?
not happening all the time? Yeah. It makes me wonder too if the answer, if there, in as much as there is an answer, we'll call it a key instead, might not exist somewhere in the future or somewhere in the past. Like the sensation of deja vu, perhaps being a key to a dream that you haven't had yet. And strangely enough, it makes you feel like you've already been there before. But perhaps the feeling of being there before is you in the future accessing it in the dream world simultaneously. Fun stuff to think about.
I think anything around deja vu, like presque vu, all of those things are definitely, worth thinking about. But here's an interesting exercise, which I was going to save for next, but I think this is really interesting because I think it's a way of actually bringing on the deja vu experience. And I'd like some more validation if anyone wants to put this to a test. But make a simple inventory of silent letter words. I mean, those are very weird. Try to explain, well, like, why? Why do, what's the point?
Night.
You know?
Why?
Yeah, it goes on. If you start making an inventory of them and you create this its own sort of strange dictionary, it's a very, very peculiar dictionary, and it does change the frequency of the mind. And you
Yeah.
might get a kind of deja vu thing that you could actually bring on, and actually it would hold stable enough for you to intersect with.
That's very cool. I will give that a shot. Unfortunately, I have to hit the sack.
Yeah, you
This has been a
do.
great
You do.
episode.
Well, get that roach maybe before you go to
Oh, I
sleep.
did. I
Oh.
hopped up while you were
Oh, okay.
talking and
Okay.
crushed it. So
I
now
believe.
I just have to clean it up now, 'cause it's the size of a this is size of a small mouse. So
It can't be really. Oh, wow. Well, I hope the Burmese python doesn't come for you tonight.
Well, hold on. Let me make sure that you can actually.
Yeah, that's pretty sizable. I understand. I understand what you're saying.
Big. It's big. But all right. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Be safe. Don't let the roaches get you.